All right, I'd like to call to order the special meeting of the Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Committee of July 22nd, 2021. Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Councilmember Beal, absent. Councilmember Hunter?
Here.
Vice Chair Walker?
Here.
Chair McCarthy?
Here. Before I call on Peter Huffman and Steve Victor to make a presentation, I just wanted to say a few things. One is just to let the audience know that Councilmember Beal will be here this evening. He's got a work conflict, so he's just running a little bit late. So we look forward to having him here. And for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, tonight we're going to talk about conditional use permits and standard permits. And as many of you are aware, on May 18th, Council passed an ordinance requesting that this committee review the non-interim regulation proposal submitted by the Planning Commission and then give back to the full council some new recommendations or modified recommendations by the end of August of this year. The non-interim regulations as were proposed by the Planning Commission talked about prohibiting fossil fuel expansion, allowing the renewable fuels to continue with the conditional use permit, allowing chemical processing to continue with the conditional use permit under certain circumstances, and creating a new category of high impact uses that would be allowed with a conditional use permit. So our first three meetings, we focused purely on the Planning Commission's recommendations as they relate to fossil fuel expansions and renewable fuels. And tonight we're gonna be talking about permitting because as I discussed, some of the substantive recommendations of the Planning Commission had to do with allowing certain uses, but only with the conditional use permit. So tonight, Steve Victor and legal counsel and Peter Huffman, Director of Planning, will kind of walk us through permitting process, standard alongside conditional use permitting, and to kind of get a better understanding of that, and so that we can move forward in our consideration of the permitting aspect of the proposals by the Planning Commission. We'll also be joined in a little while by two stakeholders, Frank Boykin, the Executive Director of the Manufacturing Industrial Council of South Sound, and Mark Martinez, Executive Secretary of the Pierce County Building and Construction Trades. Before we get going with Peter and Steve, it's worth noting at our last meeting and on the agenda that was published, we were going to first look at the proposed amendment language that we reviewed and discussed at our last meeting. But we're striking that from tonight's agenda. And so the plan is next week at our next meeting, we'll start with that amendment language. That's just simply some more things to understand and work through before we consider that again as a committee, as the entire committee. So with that, I'm going to kick it over to Steve and Peter.
Thank you, Chair. So before we get started here, I thought what we would just have a little brief conversation about permitting. And as the committee members know, a lot of discussion through the whole tide flat process about conditional use permits. And so there's this discussion about conditional use permits versus standard permitting. Sometimes you'll hear the term outright permitting. And in a real quick nutshell, standard permitting would be where you have a use that's permitted outright. So in the code, there's a table of uses, and then that is outright permitted. And then there are standards that are prescriptive standards. And typical standards would be something that would be for residential, would be building height and setback, et cetera. And so when we say standard permitting, that's like an outright permitted use. Standard permitting, depending upon if that outright permitted use and size and different sort of categories, would go through the State Environmental Policy Act, the SEPA process. And then there's conditional use permits. And I'm going to turn it over to Steve here in a second to talk about sort of what conditional use permits are from a legal perspective. But then conditional use permits are uses that are permitted through a conditional use permit. And what that means is that there is a little bit more process. There's a public process. There's some criteria in the code that the decision maker, sometimes it's the director of planning or the hearing examiner reviews the process, the project against these criteria. What we're going to present to you tonight is the Planning Commission's recommendation for the conditional use permit criteria for fossil fuels only, but the Planning Commission also recommended a conditional use permit for chemical uses and high impact uses, and the criteria that the Planning Commission recommended for those uses are almost exactly the same, if not the same, as the fossil fuel criteria, but that is slated for your next meeting. So tonight we're just going to focus on the renewable and fossil fuel discussion, CUP. And after Steve has done sort of introducing sort of the legal parameters of a CUP versus standard permitting, I will bring up that criteria and we'll briefly go through that criteria. And then Steve and I have some thoughts on the Planning Commission's recommendation as it relates to standard permitting versus CUPs. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Victor.
Thank you, Peter. So in order to say meaningful, I hope, things about conditional use permits, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what Peter talked about, which is in our code, we classify things typically uses. And by uses, we mean, is it a house? Is it a restaurant? Is it an apartment building? Is it a factory? We classify them as either permitted, conditional use, or prohibited. And when they are permitted, that's what Peter was referring to as a standard permitting track. And what that looks like is an application will come in and there are criteria, of course, in the code, even for permitted uses. And many parts of the code affect a permitted use. So, you know, everything from setbacks to heights to building code issues, street issues, all of those affect a standard, even a standard permit. And the purpose of the initial review, this is just a standard permit, is to see if this is within the kind of overall envelope that our code envisions. Is there anything in this permit that is beyond what we have addressed in the existing code? If there is something in that permitted use, the standard track, that significantly is beyond what we were trying to, what the council was trying to condition and provide for, then we will look at that through the State Environmental Policy Act. We call it the SEPA threshold. And what that allows us to do once that threshold is triggered is say, and I should say, so I'm trying to make this make sense because sometimes I struggle with it too. We will either say at the SEPA threshold, we'll look at it and say, okay, how much beyond our existing code does this extend in terms of size, in terms of traffic impact, in terms of something, you know, some other factor. And that is where we make an initial determination under SEPA. And again, this is still what we call the standard track. This is a permitted use. And that's where we get into things like a mitigated determination of non-significance, a determination of non-significance, or a determination of significance. If we know enough about the project to say, yes, it does exceed, you know, it's more traffic, but we know enough to say, but that can be mitigated by doing X, then that becomes a mitigated determination of non-significance. Yes, there is something that exceeds the existing standard code envelope, but we know enough to prescribe a remedy for it. If it goes even beyond that, and the most recent example is the U.S. oil project to replace the refinery with storage tanks, because that was, because of the magnitude of additional storage, millions of gallons, we determined that that was not, we didn't know enough about the impacts of that to issue a mitigated determination. So we issued a determination of significance. And that meant that they are going to be asked to provide a full environmental impact statement. And from that, we can assess mitigation. We can enter into a mitigation agreement with them. But that's, you know, an EIS is probably the furthest end of the standard permitting track. So that's the standard permit, the permitted use, as we say in the code. It can include SEPA. It can include environmental impact statement. That's the full spectrum of what could happen. At the other end is, of course, prohibited uses, and those are just prohibited. The council has decided we don't want to allow those uses in the zone. In the middle, then, comes finally the thing I'm supposed to talk about, which is the conditional use permit. Conditional uses, we classify them as that because they are typically one of two things. They're either something that is a use that is fairly different from the other uses in the zone, or one we just haven't seen. So, for example, there are things, business models that we can't think of right now. We don't know. They'll come in the future. If something, there's an application for something in a zone that just isn't classified, we can't find a code for it, we don't know what it is, that we treat as a conditional use and we assess it that way. The other category are things that we have considered, and by we, I mean the council ultimately makes these decisions, that we've considered and said, well, maybe this type of use could fit in this zone, but it's different enough that we think it deserves special care and special attention and a special process. And so we're going to identify that as a conditional use. One example is often, for example, a large school in what's been, you know, historically just a residential area, often is treated as a conditional use because it increases traffic, it has, you know, unknown impacts on the area. When we get into the conditional use process, we conduct an analysis that is very similar to SEPA. It also has opportunities for public input, and it has a similar goal to SEPA, which is to identify the measures, the mitigations that can make that use work in that zone. There is a perception out there that I've encountered in my career periodically, and Peter and I have worked together off and on for probably 25 years, and that is that a conditional use allows a jurisdiction, a government, to decide whether they want something. And if they don't want it, they can just say no. That's really not true. If that were true, that would mean we could be what's called arbitrary and capricious. And we can never be that. We when we do a conditional use permit, just like when we do SEPA, what we're looking for is identify the impacts of the use fully and carefully, and identify ways, requirements to mitigate those impacts. It's possible, just like it is in SEPA, that the mitigation can be so difficult that the use can't proceed. But it is never just a discretionary question of do we want this or not. And that is a piece of misinformation that's out there about conditional use permits. So The real difference, Peter's coming in. You want to say something, my friend?
Well, I would just add this, that under almost all circumstances, a new conditional use permit also requires SEPA. Yeah. there are circumstances where we're modifying an existing CUP. So it might be a minor modification to an existing conditional use permit, like a school, for example, or a park that's doing a minor modification, adding a restroom, doing some, you know, updates to a ballpark or something like that, where you wouldn't go through SEPA. That would be called a minor modification, but almost in all circumstances, a conditional use permit also goes through SEPA. So there's basically the CUP process and then the SEPA process too. Just want to add that.
Yeah, no, that's a great addition. So the fundamental difference is that a conditional use process could apply even where the SEPA threshold isn't triggered. But as Peter points out, most often it is. And so it becomes a very similar process. Ultimately, appeals of a conditional use go to the hearing examiner, who again will apply the, you know, review the criteria, the recommended mitigations in an objective way. Are they reasonable? Is there a nexus with the impacts of the project? So that is the best description that I can give of the difference between permitted, as we say, outright, conditional use or prohibited use. And in both the permitted outright and conditional use process, SEPA can come into play. On conditional use permits, it usually does, but not necessarily.
And so mechanically how this works is someone applies for a conditional use permit, and the code contains what we refer to as criteria, and the project is reviewed by the decision maker against those criteria. And what the Planning Commission has recommended is criteria in the code for CUPs that would apply to renewable and fossil fuels. And that's what I have ready to show to you what those criteria are. Unless, Chair, you want to pause here for discussion.
No, I think it's good. I just think when you should show it to Peter, but I think it's good to talk about the differences between that criterion, let's say, you know, a significant project in the port that, you know, fossil fuel project, because that's what we're talking about. But as you explained at the forefront, the CUP proposal is also for this new category of high impact use and chemical use and a few other uses, right? So it's important to understand, to me, kind of the difference between the two processes. So Planning Commission has proposed using a CUP, you know, how is that different than what the ordinary or standard permitting process is? And I think it's important because, you know, it's not the first time we've heard this, and I see your hand, Councilmember Hunter, calling you in just a sec, but you've got, you know, one side of the aisle saying, look, without the use of this process, you know, bad things could happen in this community, and this would give the city additional protection or additional discretion to, let's say, turn away or condition or mitigate projects that might, you know, want to land in our community. You have the other side saying, look, this is just, you are creating a much more discretionary process that's going to create a bunch of ambiguity and has the potential to deter investments in good projects that we all want to see. So that's kind of where the tension is. And I think one of the things that's, and I see Councilmember Beals here, thank you for being here, because I know this is your expertise. So I want to hear from you. But one of the things that's kind of frustrated me in some of the conversations we've had over the last 4 years is this idea that SEPA doesn't address a lot of these impacts to air and earth, water, impacts to housing, which are, if there is a DNS, they have to be mitigated. On the flip side of that, you have folks saying, well, there are certain projects that wouldn't trigger a DNS that could slide through without addressing those impacts and having the mitigation. So I'm just, you know, we're trying to reconcile these two pieces, because obviously with respect to fossil fuels and renewable fuels, if we move forward with some amendments that are a little bit different than the Planning Commission, we want to make sure that the permitting process that allows uses that the council wants to see in the tide flats that we believe are good for the community, we want to make sure the permitting process is as crystal clear and unambiguous as possible, at least I do, so that we are getting folks wanting to make these investments in our community and not scaring them away. So Councilmember Hunter, you had some comments before.
I do. I'm just trying to think how to thoughtfully ask the questions because every time I think I know this, and I appreciate Steve, your explanation there, and Peter, you coming in with support, but so when it comes to, as you started out with permitting, and then you said it can include a SEPA or a conditional use permit can include SEPA, and then Peter, you said it will include SEPA, is that right? And SEPA is supplemental environment, tell me again so that it's very clear and I'm not mixing and matching here.
So SEPA is the acronym for State Environmental Policy Act.
Okay.
And what SEPA requires jurisdictions to do is look at projects, and there's various sort of threshold, what we call threshold determination. So there's different things in the Washington Administrative Code, WAC, that determines whether a project goes through SEPA or not. And we call that a threshold determination. So if a project is of a certain size or a certain type, it may go through SEPA or it may not. So not all projects go through SEPA. But when it does go through SEPA, there is a review. And through that review, there's different levels of threshold determinations. Okay, so that's the SEPA process. Typically almost always a new conditional use permit, like a new school or a new park, okay, because it meets those criteria, those threshold criteria of SEPA, will require SEPA review. Does that make sense?
Same thing, they're just interwoven with
correct. So okay. Even as Steve mentioned, even a permitted use, not a CUP, a permitted use, if it hits those SEPA criteria that are in the WAC, the city does SEPA on it. But not all permitted uses trigger the threshold criteria, therefore they don't go through SEPA.
Thank you. Appreciate the clarification there.
So I'm just so there. Sometimes there are CUPs too that don't trigger that threshold that criteria. So sometimes minor CUPs may not go through SEPA.
Thank you. That is also very helpful. Just thank you, Mr. Chair. May I ask just a couple of more questions just for clarity, because I want to make sure I'm understanding the terms as we move forward on the discussion. So with the CUP process, that let's say that it triggers a SEPA, what time frame have we added to the project? What's a typical time frame? Is this something that can be turned around in 90 days? Is this something that can be turned around in 6 weeks? Or is it 6 months, a year?
So I believe it's by state law, we're required to review a conditional use permit within 120 days from acceptance. Although, so it's 120 days. Are what we'd like to have, and varies, council member, depending on what the project is, but we like to have a level of service of 90 days up to 120 days. But then again, what happens in that CUP process is oftentimes we get a lot of comments about traffic or noise or whatever, and we ask the applicant then for additional information to help us in the CUP process, which may add time to the 120 days. So that is in addition to the SEPA. And the SEPA process can vary again too, depending upon the project complexity. Obviously, if it goes into a full environmental impact statement, as Steve just pointed out, it can be, you know, a matter of years through the SEPA process. So when you have a CUP and SEPA, there is an additional amount of time, although some of them happen concurrently, but it can add time as well as another opportunity for appeal, because a CUP is appealable as well as the SEPA on that CUP.
Appealable by the business?
Appealable by a third party and the business, the applicant, as well as somebody outside the applicant.
And then what's a ballpark cost for this? So let's say it just goes quickly. We can do it all within, you know, a year's time. What is the additional cost? And I would imagine that the applicant bears the burden of that.
The permit fee is roughly, I think, around for a CUP around $6,000 or so. It varies. And then, of course, depending upon how the project goes and the size of the project, from traffic studies to, you know, if it goes obviously into appeal, it can, you know, obviously it can. And if you do an environmental impact statement, you know, it can get into the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Good. I am just trying to understand. I appreciate the attention to detail there. And I'm asking those questions because I'm trying to, you know, fully understand the perspective of the communications that we're getting from industry about the uncertainty behind the CUP process and the costs and the delays, et cetera. So this is helpful information. And I lean on my coach, Councilmember Beal. Is there something else I should be asking, Chris, that I've forgotten here, if that you think would be helpful to listening audience or whatnot? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Hunter. Councilmember Beal or Vice Chair, did you want to ask some questions before Peter keeps going? Nope. Okay. Yeah, thanks, Peter. If you just keep going, be helpful.
Okay, so let me see here. Can everybody see? Let me get back to the beginning here. So what you have before you is the Planning Commission's proposed additional criteria and standards for renewable fuels. And when you see the number 1, 2, et cetera, those are the criteria. And then there's detail beneath it. I'm just going to really quickly go through and summarize what the criteria is, the proposed criteria for the CUP. And then we can have a discussion about that. Steve and I'm going to end with some comments about it. But first of all, it's consultation, which you can see in the language here. The intent is just to make sure that all, you know, proper authorities are consulted in the proposed use to understand fully what the potential impacts are. You can see that in the last sentence there. I think one thing that is particular highlighted here is the inclusion of this of the Puyallup Tribe of Indians. Although Mr. Victor can explain in more detail how we consult the tribe through our standard permitting process in the Tide Flats area, as well as how we are required to consult with the Puyallup Tribe as part of the SEPA process, as well as many other cities as adjacent jurisdictions like Fife and the county, Federal Way, depending on the project, are also consulted with our permitting process, either just standard permitting and SEPA. So that's the first criteria. The second one is public health and safety, just that those are considered, the impacts of those are considered in the decision-making process. And you can see under that, there's a wide range of consideration in that criteria that would be considered as part of that process. And I'm not going to read through this but it just basically acknowledges that the applicant needs to demonstrate and provide detailed information relative to that criteria. Emergency services and risk management. Again, this is asking the applicant to demonstrate and show the, you know, risk to emergency services as well as to the environment. And so there's information that the applicant would provide to the city as part of the CUP. And that information would be evaluated as part of the decision-making process. And when I say evaluated, how this works is the applicant would provide this information and then the decision maker and the staff would review that. And depending upon what the project proposal is and how the project is meeting, as Steve Victor mentioned, the basic standards that are in the code, as well as those standards or mitigation measures that might be placed on the project through SEPA, there might be a determination to add additional conditions or measures of the project. Mitigation is more of a SEPA term, not a CUP term, but conditions placed on the project that would address concerns that might come up as they demonstrate how these issues are going to be dealt with. The fourth one is shoreline resources and shorelines of state significance. That would apply if the project is in the shoreline area. As you can see here, so uses within the shoreline. So obviously if you're in the tide flats area, which there are areas down in the tide flats that aren't in the shoreline, and then that puts a whole nother layer if it is in the shoreline. That's another layer. We're not even discussing that right today, but we could, is the shoreline permitting process. So if you're a conditional use permit in the shoreline, then that also involves the State Department of Ecology and its review, as well as other reviewing agencies regarding the activities proposed in the shoreline. So that could be the Corps of Engineers and others. And I might just state too on that note that in addition to just the CUP and the SEPA, depending on the project and a lot of the nature of the projects that we're talking about, there are other reviewing agencies, regulatory agencies above and beyond the city that are involved in the permitting review process of projects in the tide flats. And then special standards, there's a definition in there of major, and then just some discussion about those standards. And again, it's very similar to the criteria that we just mentioned in the Planning Commission's recommendation. And this gets into a lot of the discussion that you've had about the definitions, the previous definitions and the amendments.
Councilmember Hunter, you have your hand up.
I do have my hand up, and I believe that Claire has been kind enough to send us the documents that Peter is now referencing. So if you could go back just a couple of change of view. Are the industries, do they not have to do any of this now? Is this all new?
Well, it's not completely new. Some of it is under this. I mean, there's yes and no. So we can get you the specific redlined changes, but some of it is in place now, and some of it is new.
So, and at the risk of being annoying here, I would like to see a document of this is what it is now, and this is what would be added to it, just so that we can grasp how much the change would be, you know, that helps paint the picture of the impact on businesses and industry. And it also helps to clarify that there are already some existing standards within there that facilities and businesses have to demonstrate now. Because when as you're going through this, I'm thinking, are they not having to do any of this right now? I mean, and how much of a change is this, and how much of an impact are these proposals on what's currently in place? And again, of the entire committee, I probably am the least versed on understanding CUPs and CEPA and environmental impact statements and permitting in general. But there are interested parties, the residential parties, you know, certainly the community that in Northeast Tacoma that also is very interested in this. So if we could get that document, Peter, somewhere in the future, just for a comparison contrast, here is what's in place. Here is what these changes would be. And then we could gauge easily how much of an impact of what's being asked here, or would be helpful for me. So that's yes. Just my first request there. Then the other thing I'd like to know is there's been significant work. We keep hearing, and I'm part of that committee, and which is the Tide Flats sub-area plan. How much of this, if anything, has that committee already, has any of this been addressed in the sub-area plan, or is it on tap to be addressed in the sub-area plan? Because what I'm hearing and what I'm inclined to believe is that we are writing the de facto sub-area plan with this non-interim regulations. And if that's in fact what we're doing, then that's another thing we need to take into consideration as we move forward.
Yes, certainly, Councilmember Hunter. We will try to simplify this and definitely get you a red line between what is, you know, new and existing. But as you can see, and, you know, again, we could spend a lot of time, and that's obviously up to the chair and the committee's discretion on how much detail, because this is, you know, this is the code language, and what we probably, the best way to truly understand this is to do a case study. And, you know, again, that gets into the level of time commitment, because this is very technical, you know, information. So we'll get you the information that you just requested, and we'll also follow up with you and the committee on the sub-area plan. I just wanted to just highlight the purpose. The reason why I wanted to share this with you is after, and this is sort of the conclusion of this part of the discussion, is after reviewing this conditional use permit proposal by the Planning Commission, and after looking at the criteria and the issues that the new criterion are intended to address, it is my opinion and Mr. Victor's opinion that these issues are addressed through the SEPA process. And what we wanted to, I guess, get from the committee today was, are there issues that you see, getting back probably to these major points? One, two, so consulting these agencies, public health and safety, emergency services, and shoreline resources. Are there issues and concerns that you might have or that you have heard that would not be addressed by these additional criteria? that we might talk about, because we see these criteria that the Planning Commission is proposing addressed under SEPA, at least Steve Victor and I do. And what we want to understand is, instead of perhaps an alternative to the CUP, maybe some, what I would call, I guess, enhanced SEPA procedures for the tie flats, so that we would not necessarily have the CUP and SEPA, but the impacts that the Planning Commission was trying to address through the new CUP process could be addressed through SEPA. That's sort of what we wanted to discuss with the committee today, but certainly, Councilmember Hunter, we will get you the information that you requested and any other information that the committee members requested. But that was the intent of this discussion, and that's sort of, that is our conclusion based on the review of the Planning Commission's recommendation.
Thank you for that, Peter. So did I just hear you say that you think that if I'm processing what you said, that you think this is already covered in the SEPA program, that or process, that adding a CUP requirement would be redundant?
As a member, I'll let Peter rest for a minute and say, yes, that is our conclusion. We don't see an additional benefit to a CUP under circumstances where the kind of fossil fuel expansions that are contemplated here, like the U.S. oil example recently, are going to trigger SEPA, and they may not all result in a full EIS as the U.S. oil application did, but they will result in a full SEPA analysis. Further, at my peril, I will answer your question a little more from my perspective, which is most of the things listed here are things that we already do. We provide notification to every jurisdiction, surrounding jurisdiction, for these type of, projects that trigger the SEPA threshold. There are special requirements applicable within the 1873 survey boundary, which is all of what we're talking about, that trigger consultation, notification, and consultation with not just the Puyallup tribe, but with Pierce County. It was also a party to the agreement. And the involvement of other jurisdictions, including Department of Ecology, including the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, all of that happens because of the location. So we will do our best to tease out what the differences are. But for the most part, these are things that we already do. There's a few things that jump out as things that we don't, like reporting requirements on amounts of fuels that are transported through the facilities. And while we can ask for those, as we discussed in an earlier meeting, it is my opinion, we don't have jurisdiction to do something with that. So there are differences, but in overwhelmingly, these are things that would already happen with a permit. Another example of that is the Puget Sound Energy Facility, which was an outright permitted use at the time of application. We determined it was triggered the SEPA threshold and that it needed an environmental impact statement. And of course, it was reviewed further by other permitting jurisdictions, including Department of Ecology, including the Army Corps of Engineers, including the Coast Guard, including the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. And that was an outright permitted use at the time. So just to sort of conclude, Mr. Huffman and I looked at this, and we don't think, A, that a conditional use permit brings any additional benefit in these circumstances. And it also is not a terrific fit. Because as I indicated earlier, and conditional use permits have come under a lot of fire lately, and Peter and I both think they are incredibly useful and important tools, but we're not sure they're a good fit here. We're talking about conditional use permit in circumstances where the uses are themselves permitted uses that exist already and that are surrounded by similar uses. And that is not a circumstance in which we typically deploy a conditional use permit. So for all of those reasons, we don't think it's a good fit here, but we can incorporate any additional standards that are different from what we already do that are in this recommendation and add those to the CEPA criteria for this area as one potential solution.
I think one thing I might just add is that I do believe there is a perception that a conditional use permit lends itself to more discretion, and that discretion lends itself to the ability of the city to, arbitrarily or, place conditions or make decisions about a use. And that's not true. And so even under a conditional use permit, there still needs to be this test of nexus and proportionality, very similar to the same test that you would go with SEPA. Some would argue that SEPA is, more of a scientific type of connection, but it's the at the end of the day, the material condition or mitigation, either through a CUP, whether it's requiring landscaping or truck trip mitigation or air impacts or light and glare, the conditions that you would apply under a CUP and the mitigation that you would do under SEPA have to have a direct link to the project, and you have to you have to you have to take into consideration the baseline situation, the environment of the baseline. So if it's traffic trips, you can't take a bad situation and just have the project mitigate the current situation. It has to add to it. So there's all of these sort of legal and procedural requirements that you have to go through a CUP and SEPA. So it's just hard to find, like Steve said, the benefit based on what is listed here as the concerns, the benefit that a CUP would add, because the SEPA would cover it, and the discretion to mitigate these types of concerns under SEPA would be the same as a CUP. So yes, it seems to be duplicative, unless the committee has heard other concerns or issues that aren't being addressed here or brought up under this proposed criteria.
And the question that we wanted to leave the committee with is, Peter and I can't know or think of everything. And if there were concerns at the legislative policy level that the committee has, anyone on the committee has, that are understood to be not addressed adequately, we'd love to know what those are. We're not asking you to write code, but we would love to know if you've heard, if you have concerns that, without a CUP, some things won't be addressed, or there's risks, or there's, something missing. We would love to know what that is. We absolutely want to hear from you if that's the case.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's open it up. Vice Chair Walker, do you have some questions or comments?
Thank you for this. I think generally I'm pretty open to moving from the CUP process to the sort of enhanced SEPA process. I might want to spend a little bit more time in the weeds, just making sure that we've crossed our T's and dotted our I's. But if that's what's going to make this a cleaner process, I'm supportive of that. I did have one other question. Well, I guess, and maybe this is a question for our panelists, is my understanding is that there's a certain amount of, Peter, you mentioned the flexibility for the city, but I thought that the CUP process had some flexibility for the person applying so that they could maybe have some creativity within their projects. So if that's maybe I'm misunderstanding that, but and if the industry, which based on the emails I got today, they definitely don't want the CUP, if that's a positive, then yeah, I'm supportive in moving in this direction with, you know, some more looking more at the details.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Peter, do you want to just respond to that real quick in terms of, because I thought whether or not you can, there's more flexibility. I mean, my understanding of SEPA is SEPA applies, when SEPA applies, you got to do SEPA no matter what, right? And there's going to be, you're going to have to mitigate your impacts, air, earth, water, how, I mean, the list goes on.
SEPA is a state mandate, Chair.
Right.
So we never.
So, yeah.
Is there more flexibility, just undergoing CUP process, which really you'd only do that if you'd only do CUP if you didn't trigger SEPA.
Right? Well, Chair, in both cases, having worked on lots of both of them, both types, in both cases, there's the opportunity to identify what the right mitigation is. And while, as Peter said, we don't use mitigation as much in the CUP context, it really is the same thing. The conditions are mitigation. And so there's the opportunity to have some give and take and consider, you know, approaches to mitigation in both circumstances, Peter.
Yeah, you know, I'll just say this, you know, it depends, and it's a double-edged sword, because I do believe, you know, everyone's looking for, and I'm really not being coy here, I'm being completely serious and sincere, that everyone is looking for flexible certainty. And I think when you have standards that are very prescriptive, that everybody completely understands, you know, they're quantifiable, prescriptive standards, which are the least flexible, that oftentimes gives people the predictability, but then it also gets the applicant into a position where they have a unique circumstance that they can't meet the prescriptive standard, and that gets them into some sort of variance or departure. And perhaps in those circumstances, the CUP provides some flexibility. Oftentimes, however, the CUP is broad and the applicant doesn't know exactly what is expected of them. And the concern is that it's unpredictable. Whereas the SEPA provides, like Steve said, more state mandates. So again, it's really hard to say it's one or the other. And I would, you know, I would leave it up to the panelists. I do generally hear from applicants that the conditional use permit process lends to be less predictable and more concerning, unless it's something like a school or a park, where the actual sort of type of use that's being proposed, you know, a church or something like that, is pretty constrained in its sort of traditional scope of work, if that makes sense. See, I mean, I can just go planner-esque here, but so it's really hard to give a straight answer on that, but typically CUPs are seen as being more ambiguous than flexible and less certain, but it really depends on the type of use. Whereas the SEPA, there's some discretion in the SEPA, but that discretion has more clear boundaries, if that helps.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot. Councilmember Beal, do you have some comments, questions, feedback? Okay. Councilmember Hunter, do you have more before we bring in the panel? No, it looks like a no. Yeah. I really appreciate this discussion, especially kind of dispelling the myth that somehow if we install a CUP process that will, you know, allow the city to make, you know, more arbitrary and discretionary decisions. And I love the fact that, you know, it's on the record now from our planning director that we're doing most of this with SEPA. I mean, I can see the argument being for those projects that wouldn't trigger SEPA, the CUP would, you know, would put the city in a position to impose additional conditions. But I mean, in the limited context we're talking about this, which is, you know, allowing renewable fuels really, in the, at least for today's discussion, I mean, it seems like those projects will likely trigger SEPA, but I think that's a question worth answering. But I do think that that's the most important question, is the one that you, Peter and Steve, kind of daylighted, which is what's been proposed by the Planning Commission is missing from our current standard permitting process. And I also wanted to just say before we move on that I do think there's an opportunity, you know, independent of this code to codify consultation with the Puyallup tribe. And it'd be my intent to work with the Puyallup tribe to try and to put that in code. But I don't know that it needs to be tied to another process that's duplicative. So that's my two cents for now. So with that, I want to invite in Frank Boykin, who's the director of Manufacturing Industrial Council of the South Sound, and Mark Martinez, who's executive secretary of the Pierce County Building and Construction Trades. And welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. So I asked you to come here because as the vice chair just mentioned, we've been getting a lot of feedback, not just today and last week, but over 4 years about the impacts of adding additional permitting processes and standards to good projects that could be developed in the Port of Tacoma and provide not just jobs, but good jobs and also benefits for building a kind of a greener international maritime industrial center. So with that, I don't know who wants to go first, but please just kind of take it away and give us your comments if you would, and maybe you want to start with Frank, Mr. Boykin from the Manufacturing Industrial Council. I like your beard, sir. I haven't seen you in a while.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. For what it's worth, my wife likes it too. Good evening, Chair McCarthy, IPS committee, esteemed council members, Peter and Steve. It's good to see you, and thank you so much. I am Frank Boyd. I'm the director for the Manufacturing Industrial Council for the South Sound, a representative for the Tacoma Pierce County Chamber, representing more than 1,300 businesses in the South Sound. We are a coalition of manufacturing, industrial, and maritime businesses at work to grow and sustain jobs that support local families, which anchor Washington's economy. Thanks again for the invitation. Again, it's really good to be here. I would like to reiterate our support of the City of Tacoma and its desire to establish a process that moves the current pathway of interim regulations from a figure eight to a straight line to completion. Even more, this work of this committee is needed to work through the very complex issues of sustainable economic development in the context of dynamic transitions of our energy system. That said, I was pleased with where the conversation was going today and feel alignment with many of the comments that were made. We have been deeply concerned about the dependence on the use of cups in the current draft regulation. Broadly speaking, cups do not provide enough clarity for applicants to either invest in new projects or implement projects that modernize or otherwise upgrade existing infrastructure. Instead, we open the door to interpretive battles, reduced investment, and slower transition to projects that meet our local environmental and economic priorities. This is not a winning proposition for the City of Tacoma. So before delving into specific challenges of the current proposal, I want to provide a backdrop of how businesses make decisions regarding capital allocation. Capital allocation is the strategic process organizations use to make capital investment decisions. Through this, businesses determine how much capital will be spent and where the organization's scarce capital resources, including cash and debt capacity, will be used. Now, this process usually looks at 3 to 5 year timeframes. Businesses seek to anticipate potential problems that could make impact the pace and budget of a project prior to making the investment. This is part of an overall process by which companies compare projects in which to invest. To be clear, investment is not only made for new projects. It is also for upgrading, modernizing, and repairing existing facilities. One key element of this evaluation is a measurement of regulatory risk. Regulatory risk is the risk that a change in laws and regulations will materially impact a security, business sector, or market. A change in laws or regulations made by the government or regulatory body can increase the costs of operating a business, reduce the attractiveness of an investment, or change the competitive landscape. If a project cannot be assured that it will be able to meet permitting requirements needed for the project timeline, the risk may outweigh the project benefits. Said another way, it's just a challenge at the least. And if we don't make it a point to pay attention to that, we could have more challenges than ways forward. Even more simply, if the rules are not clear up front, it is risky to even start the project. With this background, I hope it will be more clear why we have deep concerns about the use of conditional use permits in the current proposal. Without regulatory certainty, this approach will have a chilling effect on literally any project under consideration in Tacoma. Specifically, I do want to highlight the following issues. Much of the proposed language is vague and subjective, would make implementation difficult, and would invite interpretive battles. This will delay decision-making and will likely stifle continued investment. Virtually all renewable projects would require a CUP. Considering that the state is moving forward with the cap and investment and LCFS programs, this is a bad time to slow investment in renewable projects because it risks putting Tacoma behind when the goal of this community is to be a leader in projects that support renewables. By giving so much leeway to the city to obtain a CUP, the proposed amendments criteria are so broad and unspecific, they undermine any ability to plan and get investment for projects. As an example, the city may, quote unquote, impose conditions of approval limiting the nature of the materials produced and or the scale of manufacturing operations in order to minimize the degree and severity of risks to public health and safety. In the shoreline environment, all feasible steps must be taken to avoid and minimize adverse social and economic impacts, including impacts on aquaculture, recreation, tourism, navigation, air quality, and recreational, commercial, and tribal fishing. Other significant criteria impose burdens in forms of exactions, and that is just not commensurate with the purported impact they seek to mitigate. For example, if an applicant sought to replace a single tank that was at the end of its useful life with a state-of-the-art tank, that would contribute to a more efficient, safer, and refinement process, you would believe, certainly would be the expectation. That applicant would need, however, to prepare a facility-wide analysis on how to decommission the facility site and describe how it would be rehabilitated after the site is terminated or abandoned. An applicant would need to develop a plan for how the facility would achieve an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, all to replace a single tank. The new CUP requirement criteria is untenable for business. It creates significant uncertainty and increased costs and delays in the outcome of otherwise standard permit applications. Regulated facilities will be forced to weigh the CUP uncertainty against the substantial costs of pursuing the application, as well as delays in pursuing projects. This ambiguity is a significant disincentive for improvements and puts the city at risk of jeopardizing reinvestment at all. Without the ability to make improvement or upgrades that are not only meeting market demands, but are in alignment with current and future environmental goals and regulations, the city fundamentally threatens the viability of these businesses altogether. The CUP criteria would invite uneven application, subjective-based conditions, and potential litigation. In closing, to achieve limits on certain activities in the city, it is critical to have precise rules and regulatory frameworks to achieve these goals. I believe this subcommittee is well positioned to amend the proposal before the City Council to balance regulatory certainty, sustainability, economic growth, and job development right here in Tacoma.
Thank you, Mr. Boykin. We're going to move to Mr. Martinez, and then we'll have, I'm sure we'll have some questions and dialogue with you all.
Thank you, Chair McCarthy and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Martinez. I'm with the Pierce County Building and Construction Trades Council. The council represents 18 craft unions and approximately 8,000 highly skilled and highly trained union men and women that maintain and build all of the everything you see around you, from the factories to the schools to the casinos to the gas stations to the roads and bridges. That's what my folks do. Frank is extremely articulate, and I think I'm going to leave his testimony as is. I'm not going to embellish anything that he said because he said it correctly. I want to talk about the actual human impact of what this kind of permitting does for folks. Again, with no investment, there's no building. My folks are out of a job. If there's no permit of expanding or even just modernizing a particular facility, my folks don't go to work. And I'm talking about jobs that pay over $100,000 a year with full family benefits. That's the impact we're talking about. There are 43,000 jobs down in the Tide Flats. Many of those are about maintenance, preservation, and construction of all the facilities that you see. I'll just give you some examples. West Rock Paper Mill, legacy employer. The council has about 80 maintenance workers down there. Steel workers have about 300. What do? They produce paper. You know where that paper goes? Goes in the boxes, and it makes boxes for Amazon, and it also goes to make boxes for all the fruits and vegetables, a lot of the fruits and vegetables on the West Coast. Big impact. That goes away. There's 500 jobs gone. Concrete Technology. It's been around since the early, either late 50s, if I remember. At the time, it was considered high-tech manufacturing. Quite frankly, I think it is still high-tech manufacturing. There are hundreds and hundreds of laborers down there making girders and supports for road bridges to make sure that when we want to drive someplace, we can do it safely. Snitzer Steel, another large outfit represented by operating engineers. Again, hundreds of folks working down there doing what used to be a good thing, recycling. Again, taking the detritus of our society and turning it into something useful. Now, we want those businesses to succeed because we partner with them every single day. to make them successful. Sometimes they need a new facility, or as Frank said, maybe a new tank, or maybe a new shredder, or maybe a new gas-fired turbine in order to keep my folks and others employed. And not only that, in the building trades and with the other unions, we have apprenticeship programs that are going to teach the next generation of workers how to successfully, safely, and efficiently run and take care of these facilities into the next generation. So it's not just a place to work. These facilities are also our classrooms to make sure that we have the skilled and trained workforce necessary to maintain and operate whatever comes along. If it's renewable energy, if it's a solar manufacturing facility, if it's whatever the technology comes up with, that's what the Tide Flats is to the folks that make it, that work every single day to make a paycheck. And I've talked about it before, but a lot of these legacy businesses down here at the port have retirees that live in Tacoma. They're drawing pensions from these same businesses. And there are one or two generations that have retired from these legacy, and they live. Hell, they live in my neighborhood. I'm going to be one of them pretty soon. So to have this arbitrary idea that somebody can make a decision about a permit with no certainty, without knowing what the rules are. And I think that's what business is looking for. Just tell us what the rules are. There's a start point and there's an end point in permitting. Let's start it. Let's go through the process. Let's make sure everybody has input into it. But at the end, if we've done everything that we've been asked, then that project moves forward. We don't have that now, and especially we would not have that with conditional use permits. So think about the economic, but also think about just the human impact of the Tide Flats. People's lives depend on the idea that there's certainty for business to make their decisions, to make their investments, so we can all live that American dream. With that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Frank. I want to open this up to ask my colleagues if they have any comments or questions. I mean, I'll just start out really quick, which is one of the things that I'm certain of after 4 years of talking about the Tide Flats is that this kind of limbo land we've been in from a regulatory perspective has just been bad for every goal we have in this community. It's been bad if your primary focus is reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's been bad if your primary focus is to make sure the businesses grow and the folks Mark talked about have a future. So not, it's clear to me the only way we're going to move forward as a community is if we get out of this limbo and we come to some consensus on what uses are allowed, and we then move forward with permitting and regulatory processes that are crystal clear and that scream the doors are open, that we've decided in our community, that we've decided, you know, what's good for this community in the future, to the extent we know the future. And we want everybody who wants to take on one of these projects to know that they're welcome in Tacoma. And I just feel as though, well, I know for a fact that we haven't sent that message to the business community, to the workers and to the Tide Flats over the last 4 years. But at the same time, we haven't done a whole lot to help those who showed up at the very same meetings and advocated to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I really think it's important that we just, I know there's going to be a sub-area planning process. I know that we're just talking about now interim regulations that are kind of a stopgap, but I do think there's an opportunity here to show that that we can come up with some pretty clear set of standards and processes. And so those are my comments for now. I want to see if one of my colleagues wants to chime in with a question or a comment. Councilmember Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our guest panelists for your perspective there and really honing in on what the impact, the ripple impacts are as we make these policy decisions on this very critical area in our city. I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Sometimes it feels like when we hear from the surrounding community and our activists that nothing has been done with regard to the Port of Tacoma and the tide flats. And I've lived here long enough, and I think, Mark, you probably have too, when we could literally eat the air as you went through the tide flats. And the mitigation that has taken place, West Rock would be one, Concrete Tech would be another, and Schnitzer Steel, to remedy that in because it's critical, it was necessary, it was part of environmental stewardship, and it was also part of the cleanup of the Superfund sites. One of the presentations that we did have at the, I believe it was the last sub-area, the tide flat sub-area, was from Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. There had been questions about the air quality on the tide flats, and the report was that because of the mitigation that the businesses have engaged in, the air quality in the Port of Tacoma not only met the Puget Sound Clean Air standards, they exceeded the standards to such a degree that they were becoming kind of a poster child of this is what you can do when you start to pay attention to the environmental impact of your businesses. It is possible to have environmental stewardship while we have these thriving industries, but we do need to work in partnership to do it. My final note here is earlier today in a different meeting, I learned something which I think is also ties into the ongoing effort and the continuum of environmental stewardship and working in partnership. In 1980, the Superfund was created by the federal government, which identified areas throughout the United States of where the pollution was so extreme that it became a Superfund site. The Commencement Bay area was designated in 1983 as one of those sites. And we have the news today that with the mitigation and the ongoing stewardship within that, Theophos, after 38 years, will be taken off of the Superfund site. So all of the work that's being done here with regard to the sub-area plan and also with regard to the non-interim regulations is not to be dismissive of the environmental action that's been happening there, but to move thoughtfully to both Mr. Boykin's comments and also to Mr. Martinez's comments there. There is a way that we can do this in partnership, working together to make sure that we preserve those jobs while we are also preserving the integrity of the environment. So thank you, gentlemen, for being here. And I think it's time we, you know, really do start to celebrate the gains that have been made with regard to a working waterfront that addresses the environment and keeps our community employed. Thank you, Chair McCarthy. Those are all my comments.
Thank you, Vice Chair Walker or Councilmember Beal. Yeah. Comments?
No comments. Thank you.
Okay. I guess I just have, you know, one question for the panel, which is just, you know, both of you have been along for the discussions over the last 4 years, and it would be just great And we've been talking about conditional use permits in the tide flats for 4 years, believe it or not. And under the current regulatory environment and the interim rules, expansion is, there's no limits on expansion. And right now we're going to be considering limits on expansion. But I just kind of wanted to get your feedback on what opportunities for improvement we have, not just as a city or a community, and how we approach this work. Cause we're, you know, we're 4 years into this thing. And, you know, all of us want to see the community move forward in, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also building and more job security and more of those great six-figure jobs in the port, and making sure those investments of those good projects we want to see happen in the port. So I just would love to have any of your reflections. I know you both have been along for the ride for that many years on, you know, what we need to do to really to get to that point where we can say, you know, we put together a regulatory environment that doesn't pit workers against the environment, but actually has us all working together, and, you know, we're able to kind of turn that page. I'd just love to hear your thoughts, Mark and Frank.
And I will say that I am not a land use professional, but I would say let's get the sub area plan done. I mean, that way we get everybody in the room. We all take out the baseball bats and beat each other over the head and finally come up with a solution that everybody can live with. I think that's part of the frustration I know from the people I represent, is that, just as you said, Chair McCarthy, it's not that the interim regulations are a stopgap measure when we should be concentrating on the sub area plan and moving that forward and getting that done. Then we don't have to fight in the sandbox anymore. Okay, these are the rules. And again, it's about the certainty about that, you know. Yes, and please don't take this as us being, you know, anti-environmental. We want clean air, we want clean water. There's a way to do it. Humans are really good at engineering their way out of issues. So, but we need a set of rules, and we need to all agree on that set of rules. And like I said, it needs to be somewhat of a straight line. Here's the start. Here's what the process is, but at the end, we know there's an end that we can reach through just innovation and hard work. We can get there, but we need to know what those rules are in order to get there. So that I believe that sub area plan is definitely where we need to be. And then, you know, if there are folks that you know, at the end of that, they not like it, but if we can all accept it, again, welcome to compromise. That's what I do every day in my job. That's where we need to get to.
Thank you, Mark. Frank?
Chair McCarthy, I wouldn't have much more to add. I would just remind folks, as Mark really did, there really is an inextricably linked relationship between how business unfolds and what labor looks like. And being mindful of what that is when we make decisions is extremely important to me, and certainly one of the reasons why I'm excited to be part of the MIC. The other thing that I think is most noteworthy is that we've always felt that there is certainly alignment and strength in partnership with environmental leadership and business expectations and outcomes. They have always had opportunities, in our viewpoint, with a balanced conversation to get the best of what we want here in the tide flats, and certainly when it comes, as Mark alluded to, the sub-area planning process. The last thing I would note is that we couldn't be more specific about it being a process that business undertakes. And one of those impacts is the evaluation of a measurement of regulatory risk. And that is right squarely within your purview at this point. So I just would ask the IPS committee, with your leadership, to continue to do just that, lead and move us forward. We very much so want to be a part of the process and feel as if our partnership can make a big difference in terms of where you land and how quickly we get there.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I appreciate both of you being here. I know the whole committee does. If there's no other comments from the my committee members, I'm looking at their video. It doesn't look like it at the moment. Is there, and without any further comments, unless Frank or Mark, you have any further closing comments you want to make, we would just like to say thank you for being here. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for what you're doing in this community. And couldn't agree with you more, Mark, that we just got to wrap this thing up. There's got to be some compromise. We've got to have a set of rules and we got to move forward. And I couldn't agree with you more, Frank, that the more the uncertainty we create in the regulatory environment, the more we're shooting ourselves in the foot with, for example, you know, getting renewable the projects we want to see built in our community, as well as other projects. So thank you so much for being here tonight. And with that, we will say farewell to you. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and appreciate your time and testimony. So,
thank you all,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so next topics for upcoming meetings. Claire, I'd like to call on you. Claire Goodwin, committee liaison, who does everything.
Certainly. Hi, Chair McCarthy and members of the IPS committee. Your next meeting is scheduled for a week from tonight, July 28th. The calendar right now says Planning Commission interviews. Those have been postponed to August 25th. And next week, you will hear, you'll continue the conversation on the Tideflats non-interim regulations addressing high impact and chemical uses. The meeting after that is scheduled for August 11th, addressing the residential uses, continuing the Tideflats discussion, and August 25th after that with Planning Commission interviews. And right now, you're scheduled as the final Tideflats conversation. And that's it for me.
Okay, thank you, Claire. There's light at the end of the tunnel. We're gonna be done in a month. Looking forward to that. I think the only thing I would add, as I said at the outset of this meeting, the amendments we discussed at the last two meetings, we're working on those. We're gonna discuss those again next week on July 28th at the beginning of the meeting before we discuss high impact and chemical uses. So tune in for that. With that public comment, clerk, will you please read?
Only written comments will be accepted for this meeting. Please submit public comments to ipstideflats@cityoftacoma.org. Comments will be compiled and sent to the committee and posted on the Tideflats Interim Regulations page at cityoftacoma.org/tideflatsinterim. There have been 31 comments received since your July 7th meeting.
Okay, great. And thank you. And Katie, you can tell us those comments that have received are also available online, I believe.
Yes, at the Tideflats interim page.
All right. Thank you very much. And just to kind of reiterate what I've said at every meeting, which is that there will be ample time for verbal public comment once we bring this to the council as a whole. And we've already had, I believe, three public hearings on these non-interim regulations previous to the committee discussion. So opportunities right now for written public comment, and once we hand our written recommendations to the full council, there'll be more opportunity for not just written comment but verbal comment as well. Looking forward to that, and hopefully in the council chambers, but I'm not so certain about that. So with that, I think we're done for this evening. I want to thank you, Claire and Steve and Peter and Katie and my colleagues for being here tonight, and Mr. Boykin and Mr. Martinez, and appreciate it very much. And I do wanna just invite my colleagues to reach out to myself, Mr. Huffin or Victor, in response to that kind of specific question that was asked tonight with respect to permitting being, you know, what do we think we're missing with the permitting protocol in place right now, so that we can try and see how that could fit into permitting process moving forward that doesn't overcomplicate unnecessarily how we do business here. So with that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn, Vice Chair.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All right, we stand adjourned. Thank you so much. Have a great night, everybody.